Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I have what I think will be one of the most interesting shows I've had on the air. Before getting there, I want to just take a brief reminder that my new book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, which is a guidebook for prescribers, therapists, patients, and their families, is doing really well. And it's already gone into its third printing, only been out for a few weeks. I'm getting very good feedback on it. And the book talks not just about withdrawal, but it presents a paradigm for collaborative therapy, patient-centered, person-centered collaborative therapy. And I think it is a model for good treatment in general. My guest, my very interesting and I think marvelous guest, Paris Williams, PhD clinical psychologist. His new book, Rethinking Madness, toward a paradigm shift in our understanding and treatment of psychosis. And we may wrestle a little bit with the whole concept of psychosis. Is it a good concept? Is it a bad concept? Paris has an interesting history, which we may get into. Did some very exciting things like airplane racing before he went into clinical psychology. Had an alternative experience of his own, which he says, fortunately escaped psychiatry. Paris, you there?
Yeah, hi, Peter.
Hi, Paris. I'm really looking forward to this show. I think that I'm going to be spending a few shows along the way on this issue of rethinking madness that you deal with so well. I'm really glad to have you aboard. I was so delighted when we started talking to find out that, like so many of my guests whom I haven't known personally before, you'd actually been influenced by my work. That was very heartwarming.
Yeah. Pretty much since my early days as a psychology student, I stumbled into your work, and I've just been so inspired by everything you've written about and your own life, and it's just been an ongoing inspiration for me into my career now as a professional.
Well, I really thank you for that. At my age, I'm getting a lot of satisfaction out of seeing that despite a lot of media ignoring of what those of us on the frontiers are doing, that the influence, though, has been happening on younger folks, and that's really gratifying. Would you like to talk about how you got involved in this whole issue or start anywhere you want? Let's really get into talking about rethinking madness.
Okay, it's kind of a long story, so I'll just try to put it into a nutshell. About 12 or so years ago, I a number of factors occurred, and I ended up having my own, as you say, alternative experience. Fortunately, I had the wisdom of the time to recognize that if I had just gone to a mainstream professional with what I was experiencing, I may very well have been kind of inculcated into the brain disease theory and probably coerced into taking drugs that I didn't want to take. So I was actually just really quiet about what was going on. I shared very little with other people. It was really hard. It was quite terrifying at times. And believe me, I really wanted some support. And yet I felt kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. I needed support, and yet the mainstream support I was even more scared of. So as I kind of worked towards my own healing from all that, it just became really clear to me that this is something that I really want to devote my time and my life to, is trying to make a difference in the field so that other people having similar kinds of experiences can actually get real support, whether their rights are honored, or their experiences or their feelings or needs are validated as a human being. So that's kind of where I'm at now, is becoming a psychologist myself and also involved in research with people who have had these kinds of experiences and who have recovered.
Did you actually, Paris, have to go through this all by yourself? Was there no one you could really share your struggle and your experience with?
You know, it's interesting. I did reach out to some friends, just kind of would give them little snippets, not enough to maybe scare people, frighten people, but enough to where I could at least have a little empathy and validation. And I also had, at the time when this happened, I had actually gotten a bit involved in mindfulness meditation, kind of a form of Buddhist meditation, several years earlier. And so when this all happened, I had some resources that I could turn to. There was just so much wildness going on in my mind and my experience, but I had learned that I could actually kind of redirect my attention to my body and my sensations and something tangible in the midst of this storm that I was going through. And so I kind of returned to doing a fair bit of that in my life, connecting to my breath, my body, like real self-connection, and also had sought some kind of spiritual type support from some Buddhist teachers that I had respected. And I shared probably the most with one particular abbot of a monastery what I was going through. And he actually really kind of reinforced what I was sort of believing, that I was actually going through a healing process ultimately, even though it was very chaotic. And he encouraged me to just continue as I was doing and gave me hope that everything would be okay. And it did turn out good, and that was so much more helpful than if I had gotten the message that I had some permanent brain disease, as you can imagine. So,
yeah.
Unfortunate that I was very.
Did you stay in the monastery?
I actually did spend times, not really prolonged periods of time, but several weeks here and there, actually staying at a monastery, doing some intensive practice. I actually traveled to Southeast Asia for a while. Going to different monasteries, talking to different teachers, just kind of learning. I was always, like, I never was particularly interested in taking on, like, an organized religion, but there was one aspect of Buddhism which I found so helpful, which was just this technique, this of actually just connecting with your present experience and making peace with that. And so much of my own healing, so much of my own healing was kind of utilizing the mindfulness meditation techniques to just connect with what was going on for me in the present and just learning how to actually gain equanimity with that, make peace with that.
You know, this is so important what you're saying, that here you are, an individual going to some spiritual resources, not having a lot of help, and you made peace with what you're calling this internal turmoil or chaos.
Mm.
Do you feel like talking more about the internal experience, or do you want to talk about some of the folks you've been working with and write about in your book, Rethinking Madness?
Yeah, I could say a little bit. I'll say a little bit more about my own experience compared to what many of the participants of my own research have gone through. Mine was relatively subtle. I mean, it was very intense and terrifying at times, but somehow I always managed to keep sort of a toe, at least, in what I call consensus reality. So I was always able to recognize that what was going on in my own experiences were not going to be validated or accepted by others. And so I knew that I needed to be really careful what I shared, whereas a number of my participants actually kind of got so lost into their inner world that, they often couldn't make any distinction at all between their inner world and sort of consensus reality. So that was one fortunate thing in my own experience, was I was able to kind of keep that distinction, and I think that's what kept me out of the hospital, ultimately. But basically, there's some really profound themes that occurred, where especially around the idea of kind of good versus evil, intense archetypal kind of battles going on within my own psyche around kind of good forces and evil forces, and feeling at times extremely powerful and almost kind of messianic, and other times feeling completely powerless, hopeless. So just these really profound kind of oscillations from, good, what we think of as goodness, to evilness, to power, powerlessness, hope, hopelessness. And for me, it was a very visionary kind of experience. I didn't have like kind of classic auditory hallucinations, but I did have a lot of kind of almost as if my dream world were coming alive in my wake world, and it was getting all mixed up. So actually like seeing a lot of visionary experiences as I was kind of going through my daily life, and then having some really profound and unusual belief systems that would kind of come and go, but I would always have some skepticism towards them. Again, a little different than from what the participants in my own research often got, much more kind of really lost or just really caught up in their experiences even more deeply than I did.
And yours, when you say visionary, you also, I think, from what you're chatting about, you really mean visual, that you're actually seeing more than hearing.
Yeah, it's really hard to explain someone who hasn't had these kinds of experiences, because yes, there was definitely a visual component, but it wasn't, and I know a lot of people I've talked to, a lot of my own clients and participants, it's not quite as straightforward as just saying, you know, you like literally see something visual, like in your field of vision. For some people, they have those kinds of experiences, but for a lot of people, including myself, it was really like a blending of realities. Like there is kind of this, like almost as if a dream, like a very visual dream, and a landscape of that was kind of blending with my actual kind of physical vision. And so in some way, I could almost kind of be aware of both at the same time. I could be aware of my kind of normal vision, but then there was also these very powerful dreamlike images that were kind of getting blended in. And in my own experience, I could always make a distinction between them. I could recognize, okay, so this is a different realm that's kind of intruding into my waking consciousness, and I could sort of, now I need to talk to this person. I could kind of let that go to the background a bit, even though it's still pretty distressing at times.
And you're saying, as so many folks do, that it was at least initially terrifying. How long did the terror last for you? Weeks, months, years?
Yeah, the terror, again, very, very hard to explain to the person who hasn't had this kind of experience, but it was as if my entire sort of experience and understanding of the world and myself had just kind of disintegrated. And in a sense, I was almost felt like I was at times floating in this void. People use words like existential void or annihilation anxiety. Those kinds of words sort of fit. And so there's always this kind of feeling that everything, my whole experience of the world just disintegrated to nothing. And I just sort of imagined I might end up, you know, rocking in some corner for the rest of my life, or who knows. Obviously, I never quite came down to that.
Sounds like it would be an experience you'd want to escape from.
Yeah, absolutely. I even had one vision that was particularly interesting. It was almost like I was trying to escape out of my own mind. It was really, really hard, but just this intense intra-psychic conflict of me trying to, like, I actually had a vision of like some little man inside my head trying to peel my skull apart and like get out, but yet obviously realizing the futility of that, just trying to escape from my own experience. The worst of it lasted about 6 months. And then there was a slow kind of, it was a kind of, it felt like slowly waking up from a nightmare over the next probably two years after that. It's kind of slow, but steady waking up experience. Okay, this is a nightmare and I'm coming out of it, and I will be able to work through this.
How much were you able to function, be with people, look normal during this period of time? Could you fake it?
Yeah, very well, actually. I mean, it was hard to believe at the time that I was faking it. Considering what was going on inside, I was sure people must realize. But people around me didn't seem to have any idea. And in fact, I even continued working a fair bit. I could kind of...
What were you working at? What were you doing at the time? What were you working at?
Well, it might be disturbing to some people to acknowledge I was actually teaching hang gliding. I was actually a hang gliding instructor. But I could definitely bracket these experiences. Like when I was like, okay, you know, I have to kind of go about my life. I have to interact with people. I have to fly or whatever I'm doing. This stuff was, even though it was kind of there, it was sort of like I could put it all in the background and I could be present with what I was doing. And that is really where I think the mindfulness practice was so helpful for me. I was doing, averaging 3 or 4 hours of mindfulness practice just formally every day. just, you know, and that was really helping me kind of stay present. And even what, so as I was working or interacting with people, I would just kind of connect to my breath, connect to my sensations in my body, and that would keep me really present.
Now, in your book, Rethinking Madness, and in our conversations, you've talked about how this experience can be transformative in a very positive way. How is that for you, if you'd like to talk about it?
No, sure. Well, it's kind of interesting as the carpet got ripped out from under my feet. The kind of onset for me happened fairly quickly. There's three incidents over a period of about 4 weeks, and then there was a third incident, and then literally within a few moments, it was just like whoosh, carpet got ripped out from under my feet.
Like traumatic experiences with other people that pushed you over?
No, I want to try to keep it simple, but they were actually, I'll call them paradigm shifting, like epiphanies. I basically had three very powerful epiphanies that actually were quite positive. I think still even looking back on it, like the epiphanies were very important and even essential in my own healing. I had a very difficult childhood, very distressing childhood. And so here I am in my late 20s now, and I'd kind of sort of managed to create a life of myself where I could kind of avoid all the pain from my childhood. But it was getting clear to me at that point that I was still struggling with a lot of depression, a lot of despair. And when I had these epiphanies, there was clearly a sense that I was moving towards like some kind of healing was starting to sort of happen within my psyche. The first epiphany was basically I realized, kind of from a Buddhist perspective, they talk about this sort of three marks of existence. And the first one being that the idea of suffering, that there's just something inherent about being alive, existing, that there is going to be some suffering that we have to make some peace with. And so that was the first one, was realizing, oh, I've been going through my life trying to create this perfect, happy life for myself, and I had never actually given myself a chance to really just make peace with the fact that, you know what, living it can be hard, and I just need to make peace with that. And my own distress is really more on the inside. Like, I'm looking for happiness on the outside through external activities, and it finally hit me that, you know what, I have to make peace with what's going on the inside. So that was kind of the first epiphany. And then the second was, about a week later, was a sense of, wow, I feel really, really connected with other people for the first time in my life. This experience happened, and I just realized, wow, I'm really not alone. Like, we're kind of all going through this together in our own ways, but recognizing everyone else is sort of struggling in their own way to try to make a meaningful and fulfilling life for themselves. And so that was really positive, but still very disorienting for me. These two epiphanies, I was walking around feeling very disoriented. And then the third one, I was actually watching a movie, A Beautiful Mind, in fact. And there's a moment in the movie where here's a man, he's going through his own madness process. And there's a moment when you realize that, kind of in a bit of directed brilliance, you kind of go through maybe the first hour, and you're not sure, are these experiences really happening to this person, or are they just in his mind? And at a moment you realize, oh, they're in his mind. You know, they're not really happy, at least not in consensus reality. And at that same moment, I had a very powerful epiphany that, wow, my whole world, in a sense, is actually an illusion, too. Like, I'm being bombarded by all these light waves and sound waves. And I'm kind of in this raw experience of the world, and my own mind sort of interprets everything and creates, you know, a framework for understanding the world. But all of a sudden, I realized that framework, in a sense, is, you know, quite illusional, quite illusory, I guess would be the word. And at that moment, I just suddenly experienced myself immersed in nothing but sensations and sounds and lights without any interpretation. It's really hard to explain. I kind of stumbled out of the movie theater and walked around the hallways just trying to kind of reconnect with, okay, those are walls, those are people, what's going on? And on one hand, it was really kind of exhilarating, this sort of sense of, it's hard to explain, but a deep interconnectedness of all things, really. It's like a spiritual experience on one hand, but on the other hand, it was terrifying because I really lost my whole sense of self and sense of a sort of security was just gone. So that was really the beginning of when everything got really wild for quite a long period of time.
some of this, Paris, is the quality of a drug experience, a psychedelic LSD.
Yes.
Were drugs involved? And so I don't want to embarrass you in any way. I just think it's important because it sounds so much like that.
Well, I will. Actually, they weren't, although I will acknowledge that many years earlier, about 10 years earlier, I had done some drugs, some psychedelic drugs, LSD, some mushrooms in my late teens, and now I'm in my late 20s. I'd actually been, I was drinking a bit, and I'd done ecstasy at one point, twice during that decade. But otherwise, I hadn't been doing any drugs. And in the movie theater, I was completely sober when that happened. Although it did, there was definitely sort of a flashback quality to the experience, no doubt about it. In fact, that was something that was occurring to me, although it was even more intense than anything I'd ever experienced, even on psychedelics. And something I go through my book is I think there's some parallels between what actually happens in a hallucinogenic psychedelic experience and what happens oftentimes in psychosis, what we call psychosis. I think there's some important parallels there.
And with nightmares and dreams, which you've been also alluding to, I think in a sense it's an opening up almost of the nightmare into everyday life. But I really appreciate your openness. I think it is really good for folks to have someone like yourself sharing. I don't know if you've shared this much before publicly, but I'm very grateful that you're doing it.
My pleasure. I'm coming out of the closet. I haven't really published. I've written about all this, but I haven't actually published it.
So this is a bit of a coming out for you beyond your book, then. I'm proud you're doing it here, Paris Williams. I appreciate it.
No,
what about the transformative aspect of this, the positive growth, and how can people look forward to that and encourage that?
Yeah, okay, so here I am, hard to rip out from under my feet, and what happened next is really interesting over the next few weeks. So I began meditating kind of like mad because that was the only sense of kind of anchor that I had. And now, like, I'm sort of caught in this sort of storm, and the stormy seas is what it felt like. And meditation was my only anchor in all that, you know, connecting to my body and breath. And then I realized over the next few weeks started happening with all these, like, sort of repressed emotions, feelings, early kind of childhood experiences just came flooding into my consciousness. Because in a sense, my sort of normal defenses against all that stuff, it was kind of gone. It just came flooding out, all kinds of memories of you know, traumatic issues from my childhood and my family, et cetera. And so here I was suddenly forced into sort of a crash course kind of individual psychotherapy session, you could say. And in some ways by having my own, and this isn't just me, I think this really came out in the research with participants, but when someone goes through like a madness process, there you could kind of think about it as a profound disintegration of one's personal paradigm. It gets disintegrated, and they, in many ways, they touch into the very core experience of themselves. And then a reintegration is actually able to occur at a very deep level. I like the metaphor. It's a little cliche, but I think it's apropos. It's the metaphor of like a caterpillar becoming a butterfly. So a caterpillar doesn't just grow wings and become a butterfly. The first thing it actually has to do is go through this profound process of disintegration, you know, as a pupa. And then it reintegrates as a butterfly. And so I think often in what we call psychosis or madness, that disintegration has happened. And if the person can actually be, you know, kept safe, supported, nourished, and actually, you know, given hope, oftentimes, very naturally, a reintegration will occur into a much more resource form, more resource organism than what existed previously. And it clearly happened in my case. I went through so much healing in my own case, and this occurred very obviously within all of the participants in my own research. They didn't just go back to the way they were prior to their psychosis. They actually went through into and and to a very different way of being in the world than what had existed prior to all that.
Was it a more loving, a more connected, a more caring kind of way of being for you and for others?
Absolutely. Yes, this is really what was interesting. And I was, after what had happened to me, I was like, I wonder if this is just some anomalous thing or if this is very common for people who really kind of go through this whole process. And what I did find, so actually my own research, the emphasis, the focus was on looking at lasting paradigm shifts, like what actually shifts for the person, even though I looked at a lot of other things as well. And one of the biggest shifts that everyone talked about was having a significantly increased experience of interconnectedness, like really feeling much more connected with the world, connected with themselves, connected with others, kind of a much stronger appreciation for just how interconnected everything is. And along with that, generally experience stronger feelings of like love, compassion, tolerance, all of those kinds of what I call unitive feelings became significantly stronger to greater or lesser degrees for all of my participants. And then it's interesting, when I looked for the participants, I just, to try to be as random as possible, I just took the first six who showed up that satisfied the criteria of having recovered. Five of them are now professionals in the mental health field, which, kind of, they're sort of that wounded healer archetype. You know, they've kind of been there, and now they feel very inspired to kind of to support others going through their own healing and transformative processes. That was really interesting.
I think it's important what you're saying about childhood. It sounds like there's a real close relationship for you and for most people who are going through a madness experience to a difficult, if not oppressive or abusive childhood, and how to rethink that or coming more directly into confrontation with that. Is that kind of what you experienced and what you're seeing others experience?
Yeah, and this is something I go through quite a bit more in my book as well is, sometimes, like, there's no doubt that the research shows clearly that people who've had certain kinds of abuse or neglect experiences, sexual, physical abuse, neglect, have much higher likelihoods of developing a psychotic experience later down the road. But there's also many people who go through psychosis, madness process, without having any sort of overt, obvious trauma or neglect. But what came out in kind of my own research and just also looking at the other studies out there is that there's something in the field we have what's called attachment theory, which the idea that as very young children we learn to, as toddlers, we separate from our mother and our primary caretaker, and we learn to kind of connect to a healthy sense of self, a healthy sense of autonomy, while still trusting that other people will love me for who I am. And, so a healthy attachment, what we call secure attachment, occurs when a person is able to kind of have both a sense that, I'm an autonomous being, and I feel safe and secure in my autonomy, and also feel safe and secure in connection with others. And if anything kind of goes wrong, whether it's overt trauma or sometimes it's just a bad fit between the infant and the caretaker, then that infant can develop what we call insecure attachment, where they don't feel so secure in both autonomy and in a sense of, healthy connection with others. And it seems like there's a very strong correlation with insecure attachment and the potential to develop what we, certain mental disorders later down the road and psychosis. And so this is an area of research that I actually really want to go further in myself. I think it's really important, that correlation there. And just, I'll say one more thing about that. So in infancy, there's a really kind of important individuation process that happens that I just described. But it seems like it actually occurs throughout our entire lives for all of us. I mean, if you think about it, we're all sort of all the time trying to find a balance between how do I maintain a sense of my own autonomy while also maintaining loving relationships with other people. I think that's sort of a constant ongoing process, and some of us have had better luck than others with sort of making peace with that. And what's interesting is at the next very critical part of that process happens in adolescence, when we need to kind of individuate from our family and move on to a life of our own. And that is also the time, especially late adolescence, when people are most likely to be diagnosed with a psychotic disorder like schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, etc. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I really think that that there's something really happening there with that. Here's a period of a person's life where they're having to go through this profound individuation from their family and find their own life. It also happens to be the same period of life where people are most likely to enter into a psychotic, quote-unquote, disorder.
I'm talking with Paris Williams, clinical psychologist in the Bay Area. His book is Rethinking Madness. Before we go to break, which will be signaled by the start of music, why don't you tell folks how to get in touch with you? When we come back, I mean, there's so many different things we can talk about, including what kind of language should we use. I mean, is psychosis a good word? What kind of language, and what are your other experiences with other human beings? So, how can people get in touch with you?
So you can go to my website, www.rethinkingmadness.com. That's all one word, and then just click on contact page, and then you can email me directly. That'd be the easiest way to contact
me. Rethinking Madness. Okay, thank you, Paris. We'll be back soon again. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and my wonderful, wonderful guest is Paris Williams, author of Rethinking Madness, and that's what we're trying to do. We are trying to do exactly that. Paris, what do you think this means about what kind of services, if any, we need to provide people going through madness? What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I know that's a very important question. I think, first of all, it might help to just say that I think it's really helpful to see madness and sanity as sort of on a continuum. I call the sanity-madness continuum. And this is kind of important to say this before I answer that question, because this will sort of help us flesh out, well, what kind of support is most helpful for people. If we're looking at a continuum, we might say at one end of this continuum, we'll call it sanity, is where someone is not experiencing any significant, their experience is very much in alignment with consensus reality, the reality that is that their society kind of has agreed to is the valid one. And then on the far opposite end, the madness end of the continuum, is someone we might think of who is like floridly psychotic. They're completely lost in their madness process. And then in the middle, so starting from sanity, we'll say on one side, then the next step is someone who experiences anomalous experiences, but they're not distressing. They're not significantly distressing. They might have unusual beliefs or maybe even other kinds of sensory experiences, but they don't distress the person. We tend to say that person is having psychosis, but I think in that case, hey, there's no problem. It's not harming them or anyone else. We should really just leave them alone. And then we go a little further along the spectrum. Someone who is having distressing, anomalous experiences, what we often call psychotic experiences, that are significantly distressing, but they're still able to basically meet their needs. This is, in that case, we could certainly help support them by offering them ways to make peace with these experiences. Peer support is really helpful for this. Therapy can be really helpful. There's some different modalities like CBT, empathy, just helping the person connect to their underlying needs and help them find strategies, for meeting those needs, this kind of thing. And then all the way to the kind of furthest end, the madness end, people that are going through a definite process and they're really having a hard time meeting their needs and they're really feeling overwhelmed. This is where our society really lacks, unfortunately, in the support, because there are times where people can use it. They can definitely use a residential kind of support, a very intensive support. And I know you've talked about this a bit, but some of your other guests talked about the idea of like Soteria House, Diabasis, these residential facilities that actually provide a place for people to live, but they create an environment of maximal freedom and support and empathy, maximal nourishment, and also maximal safety, without coercing them to, you know, to take psychiatric drugs, trying to convince them that they have anything wrong with their brain. And these kinds of residential programs and supports have been shown to be generally much more effective than kind of the mainstream psychiatric treatment. And we also see that same thing playing out in what we call, quote-unquote, undeveloped countries that have much higher rates of recovery. If we actually look at what happens there, for example, one area of India had by far the highest rate of recovery in the World Health Organization study. Over 70% fully recovered spontaneously without any psychiatric intervention. And when we look at what happens in those societies, they're given a lot of support from their families. There's a belief that there's something, often that there's something sort of spiritual happening or something maybe healing happening. So they're not convinced that they have anything wrong with their brain. In fact, the assumption is that they will recover. And then they usually do. So it's really interesting. In our country, like in the U.S. or other developed nations, the assumption is that they won't recover, and then they usually don't. You know, we have much lower rates of recovery in the U.S., around 30. Based on that World Health Organization study, around 30% are considered recovered in developed countries versus 50 to 70% in the poorer countries. It's interesting.
Yeah, the extended family and the lack of conventional pharmacological treatment in mental hospitals are the two factors in the World Health Organization studies. And they didn't expect this outcome, but it turns out that if you get less modern psychiatry and more extended family, you do a lot better recovering from these more extreme experiences.
Yeah, exactly. If you go down the line and you look at like all those 13 countries in that study, actually India had a couple different sections of India they looked at, there's an inverse correlation between the amount of antipsychotics used and recovery rates. It's very clear. The area of India that had by far the highest recovery rates, only 5% of them were actually kept on antipsychotics. That's really important.
So how are you doing? You're in private practice, and how does that work for you? And do you have colleagues out in California that you're relating to?
Yeah, so basically where I'm at now, I'm actually just in the process of moving. I'm moving to New Zealand, which is where my wife is from.
Goodbye. Come back. We met this wonderful psychiatrist last week at a big conference in Syracuse, and she was moving back to France, and all of us ran over to her and said, no, don't go. We have so few good psychiatrists. Stay. You're going to New Zealand? Is that what you said?
Yeah, going to New Zealand.
My friend Jeffrey Mason lives there. Do you know Jeffrey? His work?
No, I don't.
Jeffrey wrote a book about Freud in which he showed that Freud actually knew that his patients were going through child abuse, but instead blamed it on the children themselves and said they had incestuous wishes. And that way he escaped blaming his Victorian colleagues and friends for abusing their children. He sold kids out and named it the Oedipus Complex. And Jeffrey was the head of the Freud archives, and he was pretty much forced out of all of that and decided that he'd move to New Zealand with his lovely pediatrician wife and write books about animals, which he's been doing for a long time. You will love meeting Jeffrey Giesen when you get to New Zealand.
Oh, wow. Well, that's such a bummer. You know, you get people like that that are kind of willing to speak out against the status quo and then, you know, get blacklisted and ostracized, and yeah, it's really hard.
Stay in touch. I have other friends in New Zealand, so you'll have some contacts when you get there.
Yeah.
When are you going to New Zealand?
Only in 2 months.
Oh, my gosh. Well, my blessings on your venture. A lot of people love living there.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. And I think it's a much smaller country, lower population. I think there might be a chance to make a little more of a difference. It could be the site, especially the pharmaceutical industry, is just so entrenched here. It's really hard, as you know, it's a very big wall to push against. It might be a little easier in a smaller country. We'll see.
Well, I hope so. I don't know about all that, but I think that may be the case in New Zealand. Actually, I don't think there's any place the pharmaceutical industry is as powerful as in the United States.
Right.
Even in Great Britain and Australia, it's not as powerful.
Yeah, it still certainly has some power, but it's not quite as entrenched. It seems like there's definitely more room for alternatives. You can really see that already happening in New Zealand and Australia and even in Europe. This, like the Hearing Voices movement and Unusual Beliefs movement, these kinds of alternative peer support movements have generally had a much easier time getting moving over, outside of the U.S.
Well, let's continue on with this discussion of what you've learned about these experiences from yourself. And I really thank how much you were self-disclosing today, and also about others, which is what you focus on in the book. I mean, some more stuff that you feel is just really important to communicate about this experience to people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, something that came out with the factors, I really look closely. What are the factors? So here are people that they've been deep into the waters of quote-unquote madness. And they've returned to what I'm calling consensus reality. They live, on the surface anyway, looks like very ordinary lives. They've returned to meaningful, rich, fulfilling lives, and they meet their needs well. You know, what happened? What were the factors that really supported them to do that? As I talked about before, what really emerged, I think, is a term I like is organismic wisdom. That, it's really important, I think, to remember that all organisms, whether it's a human being or a plant or an insect, has a profound wisdom that's always striving towards, the continued existence and growth and healing of that being. And so even someone in a very deeply distressed place, what we call psychosis, that's still occurring. That, there's at a deep level, that organism, that being is really trying to heal, and it's so important to remember that. And unfortunately, the message they often get, they have a broken brain and they're basically taught to not sort of trust that own innate wisdom, that own innate movement towards health. And so when we look at the factors of these, of my participants, so I did three studies. I did a single case, a double case, and then a six-person case, looking really deeply into all their experiences. One of the first factor was having hope that recovery is actually possible, which is unfortunately very hard to have that in our system when we're always trying to tell people that you have a degenerative disease that's going to last you the rest of your life. It's really hard to have hope in the face of that. Yet every one of them managed to push to reject that model and develop their own understanding of their experiences that were much more hopeful. And there's so much that's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. When you don't think you're going to recover, and the research really shows this, you have a much less chance of recovering. And when you believe that you can, much higher chance that you'll be able to actually really pull through it and create a meaningful life for yourself. So I'll just go down the list here, just some of the other factors. Hope, rejecting the brain disease model. Connecting with one's aliveness, that's the word I use for this. People did it in various ways, but basically it's, really underneath all of this kind of these wild experiences that are occurring, what are the actual feelings and needs, the unmet needs here? Do I need to feel safe? Do I need a sense of trust? Whatever it is, connecting to that, connecting to a sense of agency, that I have some power, that I can actually do something. So this is all in the connecting with one's aliveness category. Connecting to the body, a sense of groundedness, like I talked about in my own experience. A lot of people said that was very important for them to do that in different ways. Creative process. Everyone had some way of connecting to their own creativity and channeling the energy, the very intense energy that often comes up in psychosis, channeling that in a healthy, creative way through art, through writing, poetry, these kinds of things.
The folks that go through this kind of experience, do you think that they are, in fact, more creative people looking for a creative purpose in their lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think people who are susceptible to, and first of all, I think everybody, you know, when put under enough distress, and we see this with torture, unfortunately, anybody can have a psychotic type experience. But there are definitely some people who are more, I think, more vulnerable to it. And some people, I think, they're just born more sensitive. I mean, they're just, regardless of what might occur in their childhood, it seems like there probably is something to the sort of genetic aspect that some temperaments, some people are born with a more sensitive temperament. And then the other thing is that some people, maybe partly temperament and probably also partly childhood experiences, other kinds of experiences, their own sort of construct of the world is a little more, it's a little more loose. It's a little less secure. So on one hand, it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, they're more likely to be creative. They're more likely to sort of think outside the box of consensus reality. On the other hand, they're also more likely to get a little overwhelmed by this sense of insecurity and feeling a little less, you know, solid in their understanding and experience of the world. So yeah, I mean, those aspects seem to be common in people who experience psychosis.
One of the things I keep thinking about, and it's a little awkward to bring up in regard to myself, just thinking about how how in my own life, what I found was that a lot of the things that I was thinking about and then began writing about, other people called madness 30 years ago and are now being more accepted. So that it's as if to some extent in some areas I've changed consensus reality. I don't know where that fits into this, but I think for one thing, it touches on just the complexity of what is consensus reality.
Exactly.
I mean, what is it? I mean, it varies from age to age and time to time. I think this is a particularly tough time for people who don't have a mechanistic view of life, but who have an intensely spiritual view of life, to find consensus for that.
Yeah.
And certainly when I started making my critique of psychiatry, there was very little consensus out there, and I had to have some sort of a faith in my own viewpoint, my own understanding, in order to keep dealing with the results of thwarting consensus reality in a way.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of artists and creative people go through.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, absolutely. And that's kind of the beauty, I think, of, you know, our existence, our society, is that, you know, there isn't just one valid, at least I should say in my humble opinion, there isn't just one solid, valid reality. It's really, I mean, it changes over time, obviously from one society to the next. I mean, if you think about it, one group of people subscribing to one religion will think another group of people with a different religion are mad, and vice versa. You know, so it's all, in many ways, it's all very relative. This is a real rabbit hole question. What is madness? What is consensus reality? So I think it's so helpful when people are having these kinds of experiences to, you know, to hold this framework and, you know, recognize that, you know, none of us really 100% knows exactly what's going on in the world and with ourselves, and to be more open and tolerant to other experiences, other beliefs. I think it's so important. And, you know, part of what happened in my own experience, I know this has happened to many others, is you start to have particularly non-consensus experiences. And as soon as, if you, you know, that's by itself, it can have a certain degree of distress or not. But then on top of that, you're told that, you know, you're told that you're mad or you have schizophrenia or whatever it is. And that suddenly adds a whole another layer to everything. It's like, oh my God, you know, you just completely, now you really freak out. Oh my God, I'm going crazy. And you lose touch of the fact that, oh yeah, that's right. There is actually this organismic wisdom within me, and I can actually trust that. And, you know, one of the things I talk about is making the distinction between what's my actual visceral experience right now versus my interpretations And so, like, when I'm working with my own clients who are having, like, what we call delusions or you know, hallucinations, helping them make that distinction. So you have this belief that you're being persecuted by the CIA. Okay, well, let's actually look at, well, what is the actual feeling and need, the unmet need? Well, obviously, you need to feel a sense of safety, so let's help you feel safe. You know, let's help you meet your needs. And then we can actually look, you know, a little more with healthy skepticism about your interpretations of the world. And maybe, you know, we can play with that a little. So it just gives a different framework for working with this stuff and for supporting people.
We've got about 4 minutes left. Talk a little bit about childhood again. Often I think people who are going through these alternative kinds of experiences have an even more vivid experience of childhood than other people. It's sort of as if you're like ordinary neurotic, you suppress your childhood, but when things break down, there's a clarity sometimes, an overwhelming clarity to the childhood experience that has to be dealt with. And maybe there's some continuity between the clarity of that childhood experience and the current sense of lack of a consensual reality, because your childhood reality is climbing in on you and cluttering you up and threatening you. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just in some ways almost easier to answer from my own experience because I was in it.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just, you know, as all this, as I said, and kind of in the early stages, as everything kind of broke down, my normal sort of defenses, I mean, it became really obvious how much I had actually been repressing so much material from my own childhood. I thought I had moved past it all and actually realized, no, I hadn't. I just sort of pushed it all down. And so, unfortunately, you know, if I had actually dealt with some of that stuff earlier in my life, I probably could have avoided having to go through such an intense process. But anyway, it all came out kind of like a volcano, because there it was, and my defenses are gone, and boom, here it all comes out. And it became so obvious that I had to deal with that stuff. And that's also what my participants said, with dealing with their relationships was like so crucial in their own recovery. And that included either healing unhealthy relationships, especially with family members, or even distancing themselves from them if healing just didn't seem feasible. And cultivating new, healthier relationships. You know, so both of those are really important.
There's some disagreement, obviously, among folks, and there's disagreement inside myself about, you know, the issue of forgiving the abusers. Have you come out on any end of that in your own mind?
I can't, you know, my own approach, I'm very experiential as a therapist, so I don't push my clients one way or the other. But what I do encourage them to do is actually engage either directly, like maybe through some mediation with the person, or using like two chair work where you have sort of imagine like the abuser in the chair and actually bring up some of the feelings and needs and really engage, you know, like bring up your own feelings. Maybe there's probably anger there, there's probably sadness. And then actually I trust in their own process and what, you know, where to go from there. You know, whether if, you know, forgiveness feels, I think forgiveness, if you jump to forgiveness too quickly, it just becomes another form of repression. So I do think it's important to actually kind of work through, resolve some of the other, unresolved feelings, you know, and often anger is a big one that often needs to be worked through, I think, before real forgiveness.
Yeah, I have enough warrior in me to feel like for some of my clients whom I care a great deal about, forgiveness should come when when their family's behind bars for child abuse.
Sure.
And then forgive, if you feel like it. If you even want to go near them again. So I'm very ambivalent about all that forgiveness stuff, but I also think that somehow or other you got to leave them behind. You got to leave the oppressors behind, however you can do it. This has been a very interesting show for me, DM. I probably have about 45 seconds left. I'm eager to have you just say a final word, and then we'll go to the music.
Yeah, you know, for anyone really struggling with this stuff, I just want you to know there's hope out there. If you go to my website, RethinkingMadness.com, I have a resources page, and it's really well laid out. Lots of alternative clinicians, therapists, lots of peer support groups. So there is help out there, alternative help. You don't have to just jump on the meds and believe you have brain disease. There's much more hopeful ways of working with this stuff.
Thank you. Harris Williams. We need to keep this dialogue going with professionals and laypersons and people who've been through it around the world. We need to keep rethinking this idea of madness and to retake it and recapture it, and above all else, to take it away from the biological psychiatrists who reduce it to brain disease when it is anything but that. Thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Peter.